It is Monday, August the 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, Syria ready to resume peace talks without preconditions.
The most important issue is that what will happen to the position of Bashar al-Assad? The Russians did not want him to just go and disappear somehow.
Also ahead, crackdowns continuing in Turkey, plus the U.S. presidential race, and who's making all the money in the world of country music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Syrian government says it is ready to resume United Nations-sponsored peace talks with the opposition in Geneva at the end of August without preconditions and without any external interference. Earlier peace talks collapsed when no deal on President Bashar al-Assad's future could be reached and when fighters on both sides of the country's deadly civil war largely ignored the ceasefires. In other developments, U.S.-backed forces have driven Islamic State extremists from 70% of the besieged city of Manbij near the Turkish border. VOA's Victor Beatty asked regional scholar Alam Payan of Ohio State University about the importance of Manbij.
I think any place that which is resupplying either men or equipment, and if that is really prevented, so that's a great success in the part of those that who are fighting against terrorism. So any interruption for either the personnel or the vehicles or equipment or supplies, so it's a successful operation.
Apparently there's been a terrible civilian loss. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights suggests that U.S. airstrikes may have resulted in some civilian casualties. Tens of thousands have led the fighting. There's a terrible toll to pay for this Islamic State insurgency.
There's no question about that. Especially the aerial bombardments. In many cases, there are the civilian casualties on both sides. So it happens. This is a war which is this is the fifth year, I think. Maybe we are closing to the sixth year. And when you look at the casualty levels, almost about 300,000 Syrians have been killed, and about half of the population of 19 million people have become displaced and refugees, either externally or internally. It's a very, very, very high cost that they have been. Almost it's very close to what happened in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan from 1979 to 1989, which is almost in numbers, the Afghan war was much longer than this. But still, in the same period of time, I think there is a loss of human life. There is no question about that.
Well, speaking of civilian suffering, there are reports of renewed fighting in Aleppo. Syrian rebel fighters led by the Islamist group Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, the former al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front, the Arar al-Sham, said they've taken over army positions in the southwestern government-held parts of Aleppo. Is this an act of desperation?
I would say so. Maybe it's not. They're not very close to be really dismantled. But whenever there is a pressure building on them, so they are going to resort to many other kinds of terrorism, probably in Europe or in the United States. So they're trying to do that in other Arab cities and capitals. So that's the desperation usually does. So they are pressured right now.
What do you make of the UN Deputy Special Envoy for Syria's trip to Damascus, holding talks with Syrian officials, sounding out the position on the possible resumption of political transition talks in Geneva? How likely is that?
Well, this is not the first time. This would be the third time this year alone that this Stefan de Mistura, who is the United Nations envoy, he's one of the top men in mediating. So there are the Russians and Americans and the Syrians are involved. It's a trilateral kind of negotiations. Probably at the end of August will take place. And no one can really predict what will happen. The most important issue is that what will happen to the position of Bashar al-Assad? The Russians did not want him to just go and disappear somehow. So that's what they're making. So the whole thing is that But the Syrians are saying that we are going to negotiation the meetings, but there should be no preconditions. The Syrians, they will fight to the end to keep Bashar al-Assad in place. This is not only, we are talking only not about Russia. Iran is also supporting Bashar al-Assad. Iran, as there is a governmental support in the case of Iran and in the case of Russia, and also from Lebanon, it's a Hezbollah. Soldiers are also supporting Bashar al-Assad. So there is some sort of potential right now, and Russians know about this, that this may, if it will continue, probably it will become a Shia-Sunni war.
Does the Syrian government, with its recent successes on the battlefield, speak from a position of strength at this point, feeling that they can go to Geneva with a stronger hand?
I don't think they have a stronger hand. If it would not be for the support from Iran and Russia, the Bashar al-Assad government cannot sustain themselves for more than a week, maybe less than that. They can collapse very, very quickly.
Alam Payan is a Middle East scholar at Ohio State University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And among the other stories we're following, Armenian gunmen surrender, ending a two-week standoff. Muslims attending interfaith services in France and Italy in a show of solidarity. Plus, Pope Francis tells crowds in Poland to embrace a new humanity. Expanded coverage of these stories, plus a lot more, at voanews.com and always on the VOA mobile app. Turkey has intensified its crackdown on officials who allegedly played a role in the failed coup in mid-July, dismissing nearly 1,400 military personnel. Among those discharged was a top aide to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who also moved to tighten his grip over the top ranks of the country's armed forces and the spy agency. Indiana University scholar Abdulkader Sino tells VOA the expansion of the crackdown was to be expected.
The coup did happen, did take place with some within the military, even though it did not include all of the officers and many of the military resisted it. And so this is an opportunity for Erdogan, who has been at odds with the military broadly in the past, to finally bring it under his control.
We also asked Professor Sino if Erdogan's crackdown is supported among his allies inside Turkey.
Well, there are several types of allies for Erdogan in Turkey. There are his supporters and those who vote for him, people who are more rooted in the religious tradition in general, except for, of course, the supporters of Gulen. Those folks, they do support this move, of course. Now, Mr. Erdogan also, because he also represents democratic institutions, has allies, has temporary allies, including parties who were his opponents in previous elections. And they're siding with him right now because they don't want to see another coup. And their tolerance of those moves is not as large as Mr. Erdogan's direct supporters. Now, many of them prefer to have a more secular Turkey and don't want to see a purge in which more secular officers are removed. Many have already been removed, even well before the coup. Then you also have, of course, the supporters of Mr. Gulen, who's here in the United States, and those folks are the main targets of those current purges. And their supporters, of course, would not like to see that.
Fethullah Gulen is a Muslim cleric who has been here in the U.S. for 17 years. Erdogan blames him or his followers for the coup attempt. Gulen is a longtime Erdogan opponent, but has denied any connection to the upheaval. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turning now to the U.S. presidential race, with the nominating conventions of the Republican Party and the Democratic Party concluded, party's nominees are crisscrossing the country looking for votes. Republicans nominated businessman Donald Trump as their candidate for president. The Democrats chose former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Pollsters are busy talking to American voters about who they'd like to see as the next president. Many of those polls show that both Trump and Clinton are dealing with unfavorable ratings. Clinton's opponent throughout much of the primary season was Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who took about 45% of the delegates going into last week's Democratic National Convention. Some of the polls are showing voters still preferring Sanders over Clinton. Generally, the polls indicate that Clinton is doing best with women voters, Hispanics, and African Americans, while Trump is appealing mostly to the working class voters, most of them white males. For some analysis, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with John Fortier. He is director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Alan Lichtman, a professor of history at American University. First, we hear from Alan Lichtman.
There's been some really fascinating surveys that give a whole different slant on the Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders crowd. It turns out that the Bernie Sanders supporters are no more liberal than the Hillary Clinton supporters. They're just a lot more angry and more extreme. So it's not as if they have fundamental policy disagreements with Hillary Clinton. They just have to kind of bank their anger a little bit and come around to someone who is vastly closer to their policies than obviously Donald Trump is on any issue of any importance to them. There's no way Hillary Clinton is going to win the white male vote in this country, but she doesn't have to. All she's got to do is make some small inroads in that vote. If she takes the white women's vote, she'll win this election overwhelmingly because she's going to win the overwhelming majority of minority votes.
How do you see it, John Fortier, with respect to demographics and the electoral map going forward for Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump? Can she, as Alan says, still win without the so-called white male vote?
We've been seeing this trend over time, and after 2012, Republicans did some called it an autopsy of their party, needed to think about expanding its reach into minority groups, young people, better Hispanic vote. And as it turns out, the nominee of the party is actually doubling down on the other strategy. Really, what has been happening, the Republican Party over time has been gaining in the white vote, the white working class vote, as it's been losing in the other groups. Is it possible to win that way? I think it is possible. It's a hard road to hoe, and I think Alan's right that really, we're talking about the margins here. 90% of the Democrats are going to stay with the traditional party. But Donald Trump is making a play for voters, certainly with immigration. And I would note doubling down on the issue of trade. Now, Hillary Clinton has kind of followed Bernie Sanders and become more skeptical, certainly, of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. We'll see how that goes. But Donald Trump is making an all-out play for an even increased vote of the white working class vote. The math for the long term, I think, was not very good at that at all. Even in the short term, it's tough. But we will see, is he able to pull off this trick by losing some, maybe some suburban and some women voters, but gaining a lot in the white working class vote, which has already moved to the Republican Party in good amounts, but doubling down on that and seeing if he can pull off a win that way.
Back to you, Alan Lichtman. On the other side, do you think that Donald Trump could break into any part of the so-called Obama-Clinton coalition among any of the groups, whether it's African-Americans or other minorities, women? Because if indeed he cannot win the election based on the white working class male vote alone, he certainly does still appeal to some women and some people who just simply do not and will not ever vote for Hillary Clinton.
Right. There's certainly a never Hillary vote. They're not necessarily going to vote for Donald Trump, though. Understand there are some alternatives, Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, Jill Stein of the Green Party, not voting. But I think Donald Trump is going to have a very difficult time breaking into any of those elements of the Obama coalition. Look, women unite strongly behind this history-making first woman presidential candidate in history. African Americans are going to vote 95% for Hillary Clinton. And Donald Trump has so alienated the Hispanic community that he's not going to be able to make inroads there either. You know, I think John is right. He's taken a different path. I'm not saying it's 100% going to lead to his defeat, but I agree with John. It's a very, very narrow and very, very difficult path for Donald Trump to follow. And he keeps making these outrageous statements, saying a dictator is a better leader than Obama. Then he says, you know, I'd like to take that little guy at the Democratic convention. I'm not sure who it was. It might have been Michael Bloomberg, and hit him so hard that his head spins. What other presidential candidate in our history would ever have gotten away with making a fraction of these statements? They would have been drummed out of the candidacy, perpetrating violence, wanting to hit someone. You know, that is so unpresidential. You know, I would say against American tradition.
Why do you think it persists? What is going on in the American electorate among those who do support him?
I think there's just so much anger and so much angst about the current situation. What Donald Trump is trying to play into, the fact that, you know, 60-some-odd percent of American people, when asked in the polls, think the country is going off in the wrong direction. And he is certainly pioneering a very, very different direction for the country. And look, this appeal, I will fix it all, it's been an appeal that strong men have made throughout history, and it's often worked. But I have to say, you know, when these strong men have gotten into office, who's benefited? Not the average person, only them and their allies.
So I guess, John Fortier, that's the message that Hillary Clinton and her running mate, Tim Kaine, will probably have to make henceforth on the campaign trail.
Well, I think you're right that they will make that argument, although they don't have to try too hard to make that argument. If Donald Trump is making it and it's in the ether, whether it will succeed or not, or whether it's all rolling off his back as it has many times, is another question. But certainly it's something that they will stress: stability and experience versus uncertainty and really volatility.
That's John Fortier. He is with the Bipartisan Policy Center. He and Alan Lichtman of American University was speaking with Carol Castiel. She's host of the VOA program Encounter. For more of their conversation, go to voanews.com and look under the Programs tab for Encounter. And now it's time to see what's trending online with my colleague G. Abby Lee. Well, G., what about the reaction to the back and forth between Donald Trump and the father of the slain American Muslim soldier?
Hi, Steve. The speech by Kaiser Khan and Trump's response to it have been trending throughout the weekend. And before I get into the latest, I want to briefly mention how it all began. Kaiser Khan, whose son got killed in Iraq in 2004, spoke at the convention and accused Trump of not sacrificing anything for the country. He also asked Trump to look for the words liberty and equal protection of law in the U.S. Constitution.
I got you, G. And what was Trump's response?
Trump tweeted, "I was viciously attacked by Mr. Khan at the Democratic convention. Am I not allowed to respond? Hillary voted for the Iraq War, not me." He's referring to an interview he did with ABC on Saturday when he said, if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe, she wasn't allowed to have anything to say. Now, that comment attracted passionate responses from both parties.
Let's hear from his own party first.
Sure. Let's start with Meghan McCain's response. She's a daughter of John McCain, who was the Republican presidential nominee back in 2008. She tweeted, "What kind of barbarian would attack the parents of a fallen soldier? But oh yeah, it's the same person who attacks POWs." She's referring to her father, who was a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War. Meghan McCain is a syndicated radio host, and she's on Twitter at Meghan McCain. Governor of Ohio John Kasich also condemned Trump's comment. He tweeted, "There is only one way to talk about Gold Star parents, with honor and respect. Captain Khan is a hero. Together we should pray for his family." More than 31,000 people liked that tweet.
What about from anyone in favor of his comment?
Not exactly a tweet, but Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions did an interview with CNN on Sunday, and he said Trump's interview was not unkind, and added that it was respectful. Now, before I go, I also want to mention the Democratic side's response. Presidential nominee Hillary Clinton tweeted, "Captain Khan and his family represent the best of America, and we salute them." That's all for me today. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can find our program, International Edition, on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Apollo 17 mission to the moon and back in December 1972 was the last of NASA's Apollo missions to fly in space. Nine of the 16 Apollo missions sent trios of astronauts beyond Earth's orbit into deep space and away from the protection of Earth's magnetic shield. A new study is suggesting a link between deep space radiation exposure and cardiovascular difficulties. The study by Florida State University's Michael Delp finds that three of the first seven deceased lunar astronauts died of a cardiovascular-related problem. Delp says another part of the study conducted with mice also shows that deep space radiation is harmful to vascular health. The study is of particular interest to NASA and other space agencies who are planning manned missions to deep space destinations such as Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, hundreds of Harry Potter fans lined up outside a London bookstore to be among the first to get their hands on the latest book about the wizard's adventures. David Pratt was among them.
It's monumental for everyone of this generation. I think it's instrumental for everyone's childhood. And to be told that there's an opportunity for another one to come out all these years later, we couldn't have dreamed about it. And it's really here, so it means so much to us all.
That latest book is Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. It is the eighth installment in the Potter saga, which are written by British author J.K. Rowling. And now there's a Harry Potter play coming up. The script, written by Jack Thorne, based on a book by Rowling, picks up 19 years after the end of the final novel. The play, which has been more than 2 years in the making, is set to attract thousands, they tell us, at London's West End. So who are the highest-paid music artists in the world of country music this year? Forbes magazine's annual list has been released, and Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk about who in the country music realm are the cash kings and queens.
Nikki, how is this Forbes list compiled?
Okay, well, it's all pre-tax money from June 1st, 2015 to June 1st, 2016. It's compiled based on record sales from Nielsen, concert tour ticket sales from Polestar, and earnings from non-musical ventures like endorsements and entrepreneurial endeavors. And fees for managers and agents and lawyers are not calculated. So,
well, tell us, who are the top five?
Okay, well, Garth Brooks is number one again, earning $70 million this year, more than any other country act in the world. His comeback tour is still in full swing, with more states and more shows being added and possibly more international dates going into 2017. And I think it's important to note that Garth's ticket prices are very affordable. So they average under $75 for all seats, where his counterparts charge like easily $100 and more. So I think that's very interesting. So if you love country, you cannot not afford to check him out. And he's also about to launch his own SiriusXM satellite radio channel later this year. So he's gotten a lot of money from his touring. Number two is Kenny Chesney with $56 million. He's gotten that from touring, endorsements, and his own Blue Chair Bay Rum. He actually has made the same amount as Justin Bieber, by the way, and $2 million than Beyonce. Interesting to note. Luke Bryan is number three with $53 million. Via touring and endorsements. Number four is Toby Keith at $47.5 million. He rakes in a killing off of his restaurant chain and other non-musical ventures. And Jason Aldean rounds out the top five with $36.5 million. And he, by the way, was the first country artist to invest in Jay-Z's title.
Well, now, who are the top women earners?
Okay, so you would think that Carrie Underwood would top the list, but she doesn't. It's actually the legendary Shania Twain. Shania is number seven with $27.5 million due to the success in large part of her residency in Las Vegas. So just doing a show. She's making a tons of money. I'm like, go Shania. Then it's Carrie at number 8. She's close behind with $26 million due to her tour and her new Kalia fitness line. Dolly Parton is number 13. Go Dolly. She's at $19 million from her varied empire that includes the Dollywood theme park. And then Miranda Lambert tops out the list, the top 15, at $18 million, which she made from touring and her business ventures like Red 55 Wine and Pink Pistol. Now, I think if she drops a new CD this year, that amount will easily skyrocket and increase her ranking. But again, that's June. I was like, if she hasn't dropped her album yet. But I think as far as the whole year of 2016, once she drops that album, her earnings will skyrocket. And if you are curious, she just made $6 million less than Blake Shelton, who actually ranks at number 9 with $24 million. But overall, I had learned from looking at this list that artists with the highest profiles or the biggest brands don't necessarily translate into being the biggest earners.
Very, very interesting. Well, you can hear music from these top-earning country artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on social media at VOA underscore music on Twitter and VOA Music on Facebook. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Looking back on the memory of the dance we shared beneath the stars above. For a moment, all the world was right. How could I have known?
Love those moments when the world's right. That is Garth Brooks, his song, The Dance. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder of the top world news, it's straight ahead. You want to stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jonah Cummings, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Ann Richard, recently announced nearly $27 million in new humanitarian assistance to support those affected by Boko Haram violence across the Lake Chad Basin region. Assistant Secretary Richard traveled in Cameroon and Chad recently to highlight the devastating impact of Boko Haram and strengthen international cooperation to ease the desperate plight of refugees and internally displaced persons in Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Approximately 9.2 million people are suffering forced displacement, deprivation, and disease across the Lake Chad Basin region, including 155,000 refugees and 2.6 million internally displaced persons. Nearly 5 million are classified as food insecure. According to the UN, the number of displaced people has tripled over the last 2 years. Recent humanitarian assessments have found possible famine conditions in parts of Nigeria, requiring immediate aid to prevent further deterioration and death. The additional funding announced on July 13th by Assistant Secretary Richard bolsters efforts by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, or UNHCR, to provide Nigerian refugees with essential assistance, such as access to clean water and sanitation facilities, health care, essential household items, and shelter. It also supports the UNHCR's protection efforts for internally displaced persons and refugees in the region, maintaining access to asylum and preventing forced returns, addressing issues of gender-based violence and sexual exploitation and abuse, and providing programs that protect children. U.S. funding also backs the expansion of urgently needed food assistance to reach hundreds of thousands more in northeastern Nigeria and in Niger. Contributions to the UN Humanitarian Air Service in Chad and Cameroon ensure the safe and reliable transport of aid workers and humanitarian cargo. This new funding brings the total U.S. government humanitarian assistance for the Lake Chad Basin humanitarian response in fiscal year 2015 and fiscal year 2016 to nearly $281 million. recently coined the most underreported, the most underfunded, and the least addressed of the big crises we face by UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Stephen O'Brien, the Lake Chad Basin crisis urgently needs a more robust response. The United States urges all nations to join in doing more to address the extraordinary level of need and to contribute generously to UN and other Lake Chad Basin humanitarian appeals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's for, what's